Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 20th of May, these are our main stories. India and Bangladesh have evacuated millions of people ahead of a cyclone classified as extremely severe, which has now made landfall. Taiwan's re-elected president has demanded that China learn to coexist with the island, but Beijing immediately dismissed her remarks. And we'll hear from a community still struggling to recover from Australia's devastating bushfires. Also in this podcast:
the God of the Bible is also the God of the genome. He can be worshipped in the cathedral or in the laboratory. His creation is majestic, awesome, intricate.
The words of a leading scientist who's won an annual prize normally associated with spirituality. And France has begun easing its COVID-19 lockdown, but will the traditional greeting kiss survive? Shortly before we came in to record this podcast, Cyclone Amphan made landfall, bringing heavy rain and strong winds to Bangladesh and eastern India from the Bay of Bengal. It's one of the most powerful South Asian storms for decades. This video was posted from the coast of Bangladesh. Nearly 3 million people have been evacuated from its path in Bangladesh and India. Snigdha Chakraborty is from Catholic Relief Services in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka, which has been organising emergency shelter for people. She told Lucy Hawkins that the COVID-19 pandemic and the fasting requirements of Ramadan are adding to people's worries.
They have been worried about their storm, the surge, because the tidal surge will be very high. The water would be very high today, tonight. So basically, people are deeply concerned about the wind, but also about the tidal water. They're also fasting this week for the Ramadan. So they are also worried about their food and the meal in the night today. So we are deeply concerned how they will pass the night today.
But has everyone who needed to be evacuated managed to leave those areas?
Yes, by now, yes. It was started since last night and people have evacuated all of them.
Our South Asia editor Jill McGivering says even though the wind speed dropped slightly as the cyclone made landfall, it's still a very severe storm.
Yes, very much so. Often the intensity does drop as these cyclonic storms reach land, and people sometimes wait until almost the last minute before they make the dash for the shelters because they've seen it before when actually by the time the winds get there, they're not too strong. But we're still talking about a storm that's classified as extremely severe. And just in the few hours before it, we heard that it had made land, we were seeing pictures of trees being uprooted, whole coastal areas being flooded, shacks and simple houses just being blown apart. So a lot of concern about what impact that this is going to have. And as that lady was describing, one of the key issues is this surge of water that they sometimes get, with some people saying it could be as high as 4 or 5 metres high. You can imagine the damage that could do.
And there has been this huge evacuation campaign made ever more complicated by social distancing, the need to social distance.
Yes, you can just imagine the problems facing the authorities trying to maintain those sorts of rules. And also partly because the evacuations tend to be a bit chaotic at the last minute as people suddenly decide, yes, OK, we can see the scale of this storm and the power and we need to move. So the numbers went up quite quickly just recently. So 2.5 million people now evacuated just in Bangladesh, 500,000 West Bengal and so on. It's partly that some of the shelters that are normally used have been actually used recently as quarantine centres. They've been somewhere that have been useful as government buildings for people who were thought to have the coronavirus. So one issue has been trying to clear those and give people confidence that if they go to those areas that they won't be at risk of getting the virus. And then also, as you say, how on earth do you social distance when you have large numbers of people in relatively small areas like this? They've tried to do it by increasing significantly by 2 or 3 times in Bangladesh the number of shelters they're using. But clearly it's going to be challenging.
Now, obviously, this is a region which is used to powerful cyclones. This one, obviously, is a very serious one. How prepared were they for it?
The preparations generally have improved dramatically in the last, you know, couple of decades because there have been a lot of storms. Everybody remembers the supercyclone in 1999 in Odisha, where nearly 10,000 people were killed. You know, since then they've got much better in terms of the meteorology, actually being aware of when the storms were coming, the speeds and so on, but also making better provision with quite a lot of support from the international community. One of the things they're stressing at the moment is trying to remind people, please stay where you are for quite a few hours until you get an all clear, because the winds can be the most intense at the beginning, but also right at the ends. And people sometimes think it's all over when actually they're still in danger.
That was our South Asia editor, Jill McGivering. The leader of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, has been sworn in for her second term as president. She and her Democratic Progressive Party won January's presidential and parliamentary elections by a landslide. In her inauguration speech, President Tsai said Taiwan would never accept Chinese rule.
I want to reiterate the words peace, parity, democracy and dialogue. We will not accept the Beijing authorities' use of one country, two systems to downgrade Taiwan and undermine the cross-strait status quo. We stand fast by this principle.
The reaction from Beijing was unequivocal, and the Defence Ministry condemned the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo for sending a congratulatory message to the Taiwanese president, saying it was a dangerous move. Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow told us more about Beijing's response.
The reaction has two parts, really. The first one was in response to what Tsai Ing-wen said, essentially laying out her vision for the future relationship between Taiwan and China. Essentially, they were treated or should be treated, Taiwan should be treated by China as an equal, of course. China doesn't treat Taiwan as an equal. It thinks it's a renegade province that ought to be reunited with the mainland. So it responded firstly to that, rejecting that suggestion out of hand. And secondly, there was anger in Beijing about Mike Pompeo, the US Secretary of State, as you mentioned there. Essentially, China wants the world just to ignore Tsai Ing-wen's inauguration. It doesn't want anyone to comment, anyone to go there, or anyone to say anything at all about it. So the fact that the most powerful country in the world has sent a congratulatory message, and also the nature of that message, saying that Taiwan is a beacon of democracy and an example to the rest of the region, has really irked and annoyed Beijing.
Now, this was Tsai Ing-wen's second term as president, and you were listening to her inauguration speech. What was your assessment of it?
Well, the speech contains many things about boosting the economy, developing democracy on the island, but of course everyone was listening to the main part about it, Taiwan's relationship with China, which is really the thing which dominates the island. You know, it's a self-governing island. It's a country in all but name, but nobody really recognises it as a country. And so everyone was looking to how Tsai Ing-wen would describe the relationship in the future. Essentially, she was quite careful. She didn't say anything that would really annoy Beijing, like we're going to declare independence. But she was quite firm, saying that she rejected Beijing's idea of its future for Taiwan. She saw Taiwan and she sees Taiwan really as an independent island striking out on its own. And she made that very clear. And in the future, that's only going to lead to more problems with China, because China isn't going to give up its demand that Taiwan reunites with the mainland. And so I can see in the future, the relationship is only going to be more and more tricky rather than less tricky.
That was Michael Bristow. A senior Palestinian official has said that a committee will discuss how to implement the announcement that President Mahmoud Abbas is ending all agreements with Israel. Mr. Abbas said late on Tuesday that he was taking this action because of Israel's plans to annex parts of the occupied West Bank. Tom Bateman has more details.
Mr. Abbas said the Palestinian government was absolving itself from all agreements with the Israelis and the Americans. Such a move, if implemented, could trigger dramatic changes on the ground in the West Bank, where accords dating back two decades affect the daily lives of Palestinians and help prop up an internationally recognised leadership. Among the most sensitive is security coordination between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Mr. Abbas has made previous threats to scrap the agreements, ultimately not delivered upon. A senior Palestinian official told the BBC the threat was serious and that a committee would discuss implementation.
Tom Bateman. In Australia, the COVID-19 pandemic has made life even more difficult for people already struggling after the country's bushfires. The government has promised hundreds of millions of dollars to help those areas worst hit, but places that rely on tourism aren't sure if they will ever recover. Shaima Khalil has been to one town in New South Wales.
Hey, hurry up!
This is the voice of Lorena Granados, running for her life on New Year's Eve. Catastrophic bushfires ravaged the small town of Mogo, turning the sky red and destroying the leather business she's owned for nearly two decades.
Our poor shop.
So these are all our sewing machines that we used to own prior to the fires burning them. You can see...
A few burned machines have been salvaged from the wreckage and now sit in front of a temporary building which was meant to give Lorena and others a chance to start trading again. Inside, Lorena's husband Gaspar stitches a few pieces of leather on a machine that's been donated to them. The handmade bags and wallets fill the small space. But with COVID-19 restrictions, barely any customers are passing through. It's another big blow to a small town which depends mainly on tourism.
It was heartbreaking and soul-destroying. Like, it, you know, all the motivation kind of went from 100 down to nothing. We had every hope that, you know, we were going to have an extremely busy Easter. We were really motivated to recover as fast as we could. That was the aim. We were not expected to be stopped in our tracks so early on in our recovery stage.
Standing in the middle of the rubble, which was once their pottery shop, Peter and Vanessa Williams go through the shattered pieces of artifacts. 5 months after the fires, they're still finding it hard to move on.
The virus has meant that everything was delayed. Workers had to be more careful. We were supposed to have the whole thing done about 3 or 4 months ago. But this devastation is a reminder every day as we drive through town what we've lost. We're really looking for a quick clean-up so that we could psychologically start again afresh, start building our lives again. So this has slowed everything down, and actually it's increased the pain a little bit.
Australia has fared better than many countries when it comes to COVID-19 cases, and restrictions are gradually being eased. But communities in tourist towns like Mogo have suffered a double whammy. First the fires, then the virus. Many have complained that getting government financial aid has been a long and draining process. And just looking at the debris and the destruction around me, it's easy to see why many people here feel left behind.
Yeah, with COVID, I feel like that subject has now, you know, taken over the fires. Everybody's forgotten that we were burnt down and, you know, I do feel like we have been forgotten about at this stage now.
There are now many signs of life in the charred forests around Mogo. Bright green leaves cover the majority of the blackened trees. But for the bushfire-affected towns across Australia, recovery still feels a long way off.
Shaima Khalil reporting from New South Wales. A lot of us are worried about our elderly relatives during this pandemic, particularly if they live a long way away. In Bolivia, one man is trying to make things easier and he's initiated a campaign to adopt a grandparent. Sergio Royala lives in La Paz, far from his parents. He was worried about how they were coping during lockdown, so he reached out on Facebook and someone who lives near them offered to help. And now Sergio is returning the favour by helping elderly people in La Paz. Sergio has been speaking to Lawrence Pollard and began by telling him about one man called Oscar.
I saw him also on Facebook, someone put a picture of him. So I started investigating where he lived, and he lived like kind of near my house. So I said, okay, I'll go look for him. If I can walk 10 squares to shop, why can't I walk like 2 or 3 blocks more to find this person and ask him, can I help you? That's all.
And what did he say when you appeared? Did he need help?
Yeah, the person that took him a picture and said, this grandparent needs help. So I said, I have to do it. Why not? And he said, I cannot go buy my food because, one, I'm old. Here in La Paz, we have very steep streets for all people to walk. It's very, very difficult. We are in a high altitude. So to go buy food, they have to carry a big bags. And so it'll be kind of difficult for them.
So Oscar lost his house in a landslide, had to build himself a shelter out of boxes, and you found him. And, of course, he wasn't allowed to go out. So what did he think when you turned up and did the shopping for him?
He said, oh, thank you very much for helping me. It'll be... many people in the neighborhood started to see what I was doing. They were giving me some pieces of bread or something to go give him. No? So it kind of became like a social situation. And the nice thing is that he was not the only one. We found like 173 old people around La Paz that were living in this situation.
Sergio Royella speaking to Lawrence Pollard. Still to come in this podcast.
These people are sick. Pelosi is a sick woman. She's got a lot of problems, a lot of mental problems.
The ratcheting up of personal vitriol in US politics. Now, some people consider the Templeton Prize controversial. To others, it's a paradox. A $1.3 million annual award given to an individual who has explored the deepest questions of the universe. This year's winner is Dr. Francis Collins, and he's been recognised for both his contribution to religion and ethics and his work developing a coronavirus vaccine. So, given that the Templeton Prize is normally associated with spirituality and religious leaders, was this something of a surprise? A question for our religious affairs editor, Martin Bashir.
I think it is, Jackie. This is regarded as the world's foremost accolade for religion and spirituality. It was started in the early 1970s by John Templeton. And as you say, it was awarded to people who had explored the deepest questions of the universe and humankind's place and purpose in it. Until 2001, it was actually called the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion. The first winner was Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, our two former laureates, and of course, in 2016, Britain's then chief rabbi at the time, Jonathan, now Lord Sacks, was given the award for his efforts to counter religious extremism. So there is something of a surprise in that this has been awarded to a man of such scientific renown.
So why Dr. Francis Collins, then?
Well, he's quite familiar with receiving accolades and awards. As you'll know, he probably is best known for his landmark discoveries of disease genes and his leadership of the International Human Genome Project, which culminated, I think, in April 2003 with the completion of a finished sequence of the human DNA instruction book. And he was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2007 and received the National Medal of Science in 2009. But aside from his work, he's also a devout Christian who's written extensively about balancing these two subjects that are often considered mutually exclusive, science and faith. I remember reading his book, The Language of God, when it was published in 2007. I've got it in front of me, and I've marked this sentence, which struck me as just a perfect balance in the mind of this man. He said, "The God of the Bible is also the God of the genome. He can be worshipped in the cathedral or in the laboratory. His creation is majestic, awesome, intricate, and it cannot be at war with itself. Only we imperfect humans start such battles, and only we can end them." And this was about integrating this notion of faith and reason. And I think that's why the Templeton Committee unanimously decided that he should be their award winner this year.
That was Martin Bashir, our religious affairs editor. She says he's fat. He says she's crazy. President Donald Trump and opposition leader Nancy Pelosi have got many Americans deeply frustrated at the level of US political debate in recent days. So how did it come to this? Jonathan Savage told us how the spat unfolded.
Well, the context, Jackie, is that President Trump announcing he's taking the anti-malarial drug hydroxychloroquine in an attempt to protect himself from COVID-19. Now, as we know, there's no evidence the drug can stop the virus, and experts say it might cause heart problems. So Nancy Pelosi was asked about this on CNN and said she'd rather he didn't take it, not just because of the message it sends, but because of her concern for Mr. Trump's own health. Her words were, especially in his age group and in his, shall we say, weight group, morbidly obese, they say. So having heard Mrs. Pelosi's comments, Mr. Trump went on the attack himself.
These people are sick. Pelosi is a sick woman. She's got a lot of problems, a lot of mental problems. We're dealing with people that have to get their act together for the good of the country. Okay, thank you very much.
And Jonathan, as is so often the case when Mr. Trump is involved, the arguments went on onto social media.
Yeah, in this war of words, if Trump and Pelosi are the generals, then Twitter users are the foot soldiers. I think we should firstly look at the claim that was made by Nancy Pelosi. Is President Trump morbidly obese? Well, according to his last annual physical, his BMI makes him technically obese, but not in the morbidly obese category. And then there's a whole debate going on over there on Twitter over why he's listed at a couple of centimetres taller than he is on his driver's licence, and all the people in the so-called girther movement who insist that the president's waistline has been underreported, but that kettle of fish has been on the boil since he took office. Now, people are accusing Nancy Pelosi of fat shaming, and not just Trump supporters. The US podcaster Brent Black says it creates a classless precedent. He adds, why stoop to his level and shame fatness? Of course, President Trump himself has been accused of fat shaming. He called a former Miss Universe Miss Piggy, saying that she gained a massive amount of weight and it was a real problem. That's just one example.
And just briefly, Jonathan, if we're talking about Trump versus Pelosi, are we perhaps not talking about something else?
Well, exactly. Don't forget, this came out of a news conference where the president was defending his handling of the coronavirus crisis. More than 92,000 people have died so far in the US. That's more than a quarter of the world's total. And some say, irrespective of where you stand politically, the wider medical crisis deserves much more attention than two political leaders taking jabs at each other's general well-being.
That was Jonathan Savage, who has lovely manners. The aerospace giant Rolls-Royce has announced plans to cut at least 9,000 jobs worldwide, more than one in six of its workforce, because of the impact of the coronavirus crisis. More than half of the company's revenues are generated in the aerospace industry. Around two-thirds of its civil aviation workers are based at its headquarters in Derby in central England. The Rolls-Royce chief executive is Warren East.
We are going to have to lose about 9,000 people, and that is about protecting the future of our business and therefore protecting the remaining 40,000 plus jobs or so. And unfortunately, that's just the reality of the consequence of the virus disruption for our industry as a whole.
Warren East, chief executive of Rolls-Royce. Earlier this week, Uganda announced an easing of its lockdown measures, including potentially opening schools within weeks for students due to sit key exams. Less than half of the population has access to the internet in Uganda, and the government is using broadcasts as well as online and printed study guides to help students. But how effective are they? Catherine Biarahanga reports.
Plants or animals do die. More organic matter. Broken down or decomposed.
18-year-old Angel Ayinyo is sat down on a mattress in the middle of a small one-room mud structure she shares with six family members. She carefully takes down notes as she listens to a radio lesson for biology on the national broadcaster. Without a phone, TV, access to the internet or textbooks, this is her only way to learn during the COVID-19 lockdown. But Angel worries she's falling behind.
Some of my colleagues have their TVs and their phones. That's where they get their notes and they always consult their teachers, because our teachers gave us the WhatsApp numbers to consult them whenever we get any stuck.
The Next year, Angel is meant to sit her O-level exams, a standardized test for all learners in the country. It's almost impossible for her to concentrate at home with her younger brothers and sisters crying and running around. Angel and her family live in a small fishing village right by the shores of Lake Victoria. Just a few weeks ago, their previous home was destroyed by flooding. While her daughter studies, Angel's mother, Cons Aluku, is busy outside mixing soil and water as she tries to finish building their new home further inland. Cons has only been able to afford school fees for two of her five children. She's worried the lockdown will impact their education. The government here began its national programme for access to education during the COVID-19 lockdown in April. Alex Kakoza, the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Education, says the multimedia approach was intended to help reach all children, especially the most vulnerable.
When we close schools, there are a number of things that happen. For example, the dropout rate increases. You get early marriages, you get child labour. Initially, it was basically to mobilise our children. Say, you'll be missing ABCD, but there is hope. Tomorrow you go back to school.
However, officials say they do not know how many students are actually listening or watching the lessons or using the printed study guides.
How long is the poem?
The poem is three stanzas.
30 kilometres away in an apartment block on the outskirts of Kampala, learning under lockdown is very different for 11-year-old Jordana Alinda and her mother, Anna Natakunda.
She tries to help. I know the answer, then she knows the answer, then we ask Google and Google knows a different answer, and then the teacher knows a different answer, and usually the teacher is correct or Google.
Some money is never correct.
Teachers really, they are always right.
Jordana's private school provides daily lessons posted on the internet and sends weekend work to her mother's phone via WhatsApp. The COVID-19 pandemic continues to expose the inequalities in our societies. Education experts warn it could further widen the gap in access to learning between the rich and the poor.
Catherine Biarahanga reporting from Uganda. Finally, as the lockdown has begun easing in several European nations, people have been meeting again with family and friends. But how are they actually greeting each other? In France, for example, are they still using the traditional quick kiss on the cheeks, or has social distancing banished this affectionate habit for good? Alexandre Lacroix, editor of the French magazine La Philosophie, has written an article about it, and Lawrence Pollard, who describes himself as a reserved Brit, asked him whether he believes French people will continue this customary kiss.
The future of kissing may be impacted by this pandemic for sure. At least it will be impacted if social distancing measures are going to last for long. And I'm not sure that the new experiments that are now tested, for example, heel nodding or elbow tapping, will really install a new code. What we may experience is a lack of clear code, which means that in a lot of Protestant countries, in Germany, for example, it is interesting to notice that there is no consensus on how to greet each other. And so at the first encounter, there is a short phase of hesitation and discomfort.
So it's almost as if embarrassment becomes the way that we greet ourselves because we're uncertain of those codes. Do you think that there is anything that can take the place of the peck on the cheek? Because certainly in the UK, it's a bit of a recent introduction. I'm not always comfortable with pecking someone on the cheek. I don't know if they're the accepted level of intimacy and so on. Isn't there something that can take its place?
Maybe it would be a kind of a permanent social distancing. There was something like that in history. Back in history, there was a huge social distancing at the late Middle Age. Because before, amongst Christians, the use was to kiss on the mouth. So for a Brit, for you, for example, it would have been all the more difficult to accept. But this tradition was lost at the late Middle Age and was replaced by kissing and handshakes.
Now that's fascinating. So we used to lip kiss in Europe rather than just do a peck on the cheek.
Yes, because the origins of this, I show it in my essay on kissing. The origins in the begins with the Roman Empire. Kissing is a social code which belongs to the Romans. And for them, it means when you kiss someone on the mouth, it means that you are equals.
Goodness, I've got to say, I think we've left our listeners with further reading. Alexandra Lacroix's essay on kissing. Required reading, please.
Absolutely. Some historical revelations there for Laurence Pollard from Alexandra Lacroix, the editor of La Philosophie magazine. And that's it from us for now. But there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, mwah.